Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. While most people of goodwill have long rejected war as a legitimate course of action, their governments continue investing in new armaments and larger armies, therefore affirming with the taxpayers' money that war is still a continuation of politics or geopolitics by other means. Can the fear and moral rejection of war obscure something hidden and yet perpetuating about its nature? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Syed Atta Hasnain, a retired Lieutenant General of the Indian Army and a former commander of the Indian Army in Kashmir. General, it's great pleasure, great honor for me to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be on your program.
Now, I take it from your writing that things, even the most unexpected things, rarely arise out of the blue, that they usually have antecedents, even if those antecedents may have been obscured. If we take the Russia-Ukraine conflict, which you, by the way, describe as a proxy war between NATO and Russia, what are some of the underlying reasons for it?
See, of course, it's a very, very complex geopolitical situation which is existing there in, Eurasia, Central Eastern Europe, or places like that, whatever way you want to describe it. But obviously, the root cause of it goes back to 1945-46, the end of the Second World War, and the subsequent Cold War, which existed for the better part of 44 years, in which finally the Soviet Union broke up. And all the states which were part of the Soviet Union, 15 states, the Commonwealth of Independent States subsequently, and the Warsaw Pact states, who opposed NATO and ensured the balance of power in Europe, they too started joining the NATO side. And it was therefore NATO's victory, virtually military victory in the Cold War, which was pushing the former Soviet Union, Russia, backwards. There was a tolerance, there was a level of tolerance, a red line which existed. It was very difficult defining that red line. And Russia continued to accept the NATO offensive conduct of its geopolitics. There were no operations as such, and finally stopped at Ukraine. Mm-hmm. While all of the countries could join NATO and could not directly threaten Russia, but Ukraine becoming an integral part of NATO would result in direct threat to the Russian mm-hmm. homeland.
Can I ask you specifically about Ukraine? Because we've had a lot of American political analysts and gurus writing about how critical Ukraine is for Russia. That, remember that famous Brzezinski quote that without Ukraine, Russia can never consider itself a great power or an empire. Do you think the substance of Russia's objections, do they come down to emotions and nostalgia, the Soviet nostalgia, or do they have sort of military strategy at their core?
Neither of them. I think it's realpolitik. And it's Russia was fully justified about one thing. Just Russia, the only access that Russia has to this waters anywhere in the world is primarily the Arctic Circle into the Arctic Sea, or it is from Vladivostok towards the Pacific Ocean. There is no other way that the Russians have got access to the sea except the Black Sea. Now, in the Black Sea itself, it is through Ukraine that Russia exercises sea power. You know, it's the whole area of Crimea, the Sea of Azov, and the ports existing there, including Odessa and things, places like that. I strongly always have subscribed to this idea that everything is acceptable. Even a land-based threat to Russia is acceptable. But leaving Russia without access to the Black Sea is actually irking Russia, is actually instigating Russia to respond. And this is exactly what happened. My last point on this particular argument is the fact that in 2015, Russia went to the port of Latakia in Syria, was deployed there. Also the air base there. It was so important for Russia because that is the only manner in which it can have access to the Mediterranean, into the area of the Gulf, and the very, very important strategic region of the world.
So Russia was essentially pursuing its strategic interests, but in case of Syria, it was doing that in accordance, in agreement with the legitimate and UN-recognized Syrian government. And when it comes to Ukraine, one could argue that Ukraine is a sovereign nation, that it is up to itself to define who it wants to be associated with. And yet you still claim that Russia on Ukraine had been pushed to a hilt. What do you mean by that?
You see, this plays both ways. And you've seen the stance that, and I go entirely by the manner in which India has played this out. India has taken neither side. It's only analyzed, it's only argued for both sides.
And that's why your perspective is so valuable, because you are distanced from both protagonists.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would say NATO, justification of NATO is to push eastwards and as a democratic right. Any nation has got the capability and the right to join any other nation, any other organization, any other entity to advance its needs for its own people. And this is exactly what the NATO argument is here. But if you really see it in real politics, after the end of the Cold War, the NATO push eastwards into the Warsaw Pact zone, the former Warsaw Pact zone, was all about making it almost impossible for Russia ever to revive, leaving it no options at all. While the Russians, weak as they were in 1989, weak as they were in the 90s at that time, could not respond. Mm-hmm. When Russian power became more comprehensive, became stronger, Russia started responding. And that's why you found in 2014, President Putin finally responded, and not with conventional war. He responded with hybrid war. This was some of the classic hybrid campaigns which was fought out in Crimea and in the areas like that. So both sides have got their justifications to do what they are doing at the moment. Our argument, my argument only as a analyst, is that if both sides had made their statements through various acts, armed acts, whatever they had done, they must realize that this war is unwinnable. Neither side can win this war.
American military strategists have been writing about this idea of the proxy war as a cheaper and faster substitute for a conventional war. And I think for some time the Russians have played along, even though the American capabilities to shape and to influence and sometimes distort global public opinion are much more superior than Russia's. But I wonder if deciding to deploy this traditional conventional force, the Kremlin was aiming not only for defending its strategic interests, but also for sort of challenging this American paradigm that perception is reality, that you win or lose war on television screens rather than on the actual battlefield.
Actually, yes, it's even more complex than what you have explained at the moment. It's not just a question of a direct confrontation. What the Russian side decided finally was that a red line had been crossed. Right, we, most of us who were analyzing at that particular time in February last year, 24th of February to be precise, were of the opinion, because we were reading too much into how the world had shaped post the pandemic in particular, and we were thinking that no nation will probably want to go to conventional war at this particular stage. But if we had gone perhaps deeper and understood the Russian mind, we would have realized that the red lines had already been crossed, and President Putin was willing to commit his conventional forces to defend Russian interests in Eastern Europe. That is very clear. As far as the Americans are concerned, they were clear that it would be a proxy war. that they would not commit their own troops, they would not commit European troops. It is through Ukraine, through the comprehensive national power of Ukraine only that this will be fought. I'm not sure whether this is a winnable strategy. Although I'm also not for American deployment or any other NATO deployment, because that will make the situation so, so dangerous that we are almost staring into the eyes of a third world war. But both sides now at this stage have to realize that this war is unwinnable. It is causing miseries not to their own people, it's causing miseries to the whole world. The energy crisis, the post-pandemic economic recovery, which is so necessary for the whole world, a food crisis, everything is happening here. I was expecting that by the month of February, something will start, something positive will start moving. But now I'm getting less hopeful than what I was.
Now, India is home to one of the world's greatest nonviolent resistance traditions, but you also have one of the world's strongest armies. And I wonder, how did it shape your own domestic discourse around the Russian-Ukrainian war and more generally about the application of this conventional military capability? Do you think it perhaps legitimized the use of force, the limited use of force in the eyes of the Indian public? Because you also have your fair share of, conflicts with your neighbors.
Well, a very good question indeed. We are one of the nations suffering from terrorism, proxy terrorism, for the better part of 30 years. It's a proxy war which is being fought in Kashmir, and that's the place where I commanded my troops to some years ago. Having said that, there is no one as conscious of India as India about the effects of proxy war and what it can lead to. Proxy wars can spark off conventional wars at different moments. We've had our own share of this in the past couple of years. We've overcome it. So we know how dangerous proxy wars are. In 2014, when Russia decided to launch a proxy war in Crimea, in its general area of interest in the Ukraine.
I'm sure you know that Russia believes that it's the Ukrainian side that and the West that initiated that crisis with the overthrow of the legitimate government.
I'm fully aware of it. I'm fully aware of what happened. There are perceptions about it. But yes, there are certain facts which we cannot deny. It was a question of pushing, and that push came to a shove at the end, and there was a response from the Russian side. I would not justify this publicly from either side. But I would say that yes, the Russians decided not to go in conventionally. 2014 was not a time when conventional war was being looked at as a means of resolving conflicts. Not that it is being looked at today either. But 2014 was perhaps a time when I would say Russia had bounced back sufficiently. I visited your country, a very beautiful capital, Moscow, in 2015. And I got lots of strategic briefings at think tanks and places like that. I started understanding the Russian mind far better. And I realized that 2014, Russia had been pushed. And in most of my writings, you will find that I always tend to give a perception that Russia was weak, it could not respond, it wanted to come back and be a competitive organization with, as far as NATO was concerned, but that was not possible. That can only be possible if Russia gives a pushback. Mm-hmm. That pushback had to start from somewhere. It started from Ukraine, and 2014 was a time by which time Russia, the Russian economy, the Russian comprehensive national power, its leadership and strategic capability had all come into place. But having said that, the last word on that, I was surprised at the inability of the Russian military to make initial headway into conventional operations from 24th of February last year. That came as a surprise to most of us who know the Russian armed forces so well.
Well, General, let's pause here for a moment, but we will be back to the discussion in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
So So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Putin is on offense. Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
November 22, 2022. Outraged Orthodox Christians confronted Ukrainian security service officers, blocking entrances and exits to Kyiv's oldest monastery. They were looking for alleged Russian spies among the monks.
We имеем дело с именно с религиозной войной.
The former reason for the brutal crackdown, one church's parishioners had sung a song about Russia. It's long been reason enough to condemn any Orthodox Christian, attack, imprison, and even kill them.
Наши враги, наши оппоненты прекрасно понимают, что не уничтожив православие, они не уничтожат Россию.
Есть места, которые соединяют землю с небом, а есть места, где соединение идет с адом.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Syed Atta Hasnain, a retired Lieutenant General of the Indian Army and a former commander of the Indian Army in Kashmir. General, before the break, we were discussing your perception of Russia sort of being pushed and pushed and pushed, and then finally finding enough, strength and perhaps resentment to push back. And you've also written in one of your articles that someone should have anticipated, someone within NATO or someone within the Western camp should have anticipated that at some stage, Russia will rise and demand some dignity. Isn't that true about any nation, no matter how big or small it is, that its minimum interests need to be respected? Isn't that also true in the case of Ukraine when it comes to Russia's offensive?
If you remember, when one of the first articles that I wrote, I started with the mention of the Treaty of Versailles, 1919. And I said that was the biggest mistake that the Allies made at that time, not retaining the dignity of the defeated German state. And you saw what happened 20 years later.
I hope you're not comparing the modern-day Russia to Nazi Germany, but I understand that this the failure to address the proper termination of war is leading to a conflict. That's, I guess, your main point.
Absolutely. Conflict termination is such an important aspect of the whole conflict process. You see, it's not a question of leaving it at conflict resolution or whatever it is. Termination, the right time, and then taking it beyond in resolution to make sure that it is a comprehensive solution which comes about. It addresses not just the military, not just the political, but the psychological aspects too, as far as the ego of the people, so the civilization is concerned. None of this happened. Now, in this case, I strongly do feel that from 1989 onwards, the victorious Western world did push Russia back eastwards, making sure that their comprehensive national power did not emerge to that levels. There were ways and means of doing it. One of them was, of course, economic. The other was militarily to ensure that Russia, reduces its overall military power. But the most important aspect was psychological. They tried to impose on the Russian side that they could not come back ever again. Now that, I think, somehow was a mistake.
Both the Biden and Zelensky administration are portraying this war in very ontological terms. For Zelensky, it's an existential fight of freedom versus terrorism or tyranny. The Biden administration describes this as a struggle between the forces of democracy and the forces of authoritarianism or totalitarianism. I wonder if there could be any psychological resolution for the Ukrainians or the Americans for that matter, when the conflict is framed in those terms, the ultimate forces of good against the ultimate forces of evil, and by the latter, they mean Russia, what kind of a psychological resolution could be there with the devil?
This is one of those rare wars where I find it very difficult to find the villain. And I'm finding too that both sides are to blame as far as the war itself is concerned. But as far as the push towards war, as far as the instigation is concerned, I do put a greater blame on the NATO side, because I do feel that the victor in a war, and the Cold War was as much a war as the First World War or the Second World War, the victor at the end of a war needs to be magnanimous in terms of his victory and what he tends to achieve. At the end of the day, he has to ensure that war does not return to the same zone again. I don't think the West, I don't think NATO looked through this, did not analyze it through to see that psychologically they were creating a set of people whose basic ideologies, whose essential existence with honor and pride was being ground down, was being brought down to the Mother Earth. And that this lot would rise again, maybe not as quickly as Germany did, but someday it would rise again. Mm-hmm. The Russian side has risen much faster than that, and actually has come back in a matter of just 24 years, when 2014 we saw that the proxy war started. So at the end of the day, I still feel that, I mean, to answer your question directly, at the end of the day, I still feel dead now. It is none of what is being spoken by the United States or by Ukraine is actually true. They're fighting a war essentially to prevent the return, the resurgence of Russian power once again in this region, and to ensure that that is postponed to the furthest limits as far as it's possible. The only solution to it is to ensure a ceasefire. Come to the table. It will be a long, drawn-out engagement process. This is not going to be about territory. It is not going to be about national power or anything. It's going to be about existence.
Now, General, most of our viewers are not strategists, and I wonder if you can give us a sense of how decision makers arrive at that balance of pushing against an unpleasant neighbor, but also not going too far and not allowing others to exploit your legitimate grievances for their own aims. I guess I'm asking you about how to delineate your own war from the wars that others want you to fight for them.
Yes, this is a sense of responsibility which decision makers have to bear always. And they have to ensure that in their enthusiasm, particularly when they are in a victorious mode, in their enthusiasm, they do not overstep and they do not go beyond, because this can lead to something, this can escalate to something which is, you know, far beyond. For example, 4 months ago, 3 months ago, we were finding that the steps moving towards a nuclear engagement becoming more and more serious. We were finding President Putin talking about it very often, although the NATO side would not. The NATO side was much more responsible about it. But the Russian side, at that time, particularly with the counteroffensives having started from the Ukrainian side, they were on the back foot, and that is the time when these kind of statements were being made. No, that has stopped. That has mercifully stopped, and obviously some kind of a sense of responsibility has returned. But what I want to highlight to your viewers is, if we are living in a world of information warfare, intense information warfare, perception management, communication strategy, this is going to make war fighting that much more complex, because the truth, no one knows what the truth is. What is coming out in the Western media today in terms of the situation in Ukraine, do I necessarily have to believe it? Does what is being spoken about in Russia, do I have to necessarily believe it? I have to get the right information to understand this war. And that is not coming my way. And this is going to be a challenge in the future in all wars.
Speaking about all future wars, there is one potential conflict that a lot of international media are talking about. I mean the supposed intention of Beijing to take control over Taiwan, and taking stock of the at times quite provocative American diplomacy, it's hard for me to figure out whether the Americans actually want to prevent that from happening or whether they are trying to egg China on to push it into action and to create a pretext for broader confrontation with Beijing. What's your sense of it?
You see, well, we can give specific reference to the visit of the U.S. Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, when she went to Taiwan a matter of about 4 months or maybe 5 months ago, and the provocation which came about at that time. And that's the best example to understand this whole situation. I think the U.S., at one stage, I felt the U.S. was overplaying its cards, and that it was being very provocative. It was taking a very deep risk. And in the situation of what was happening in Ukraine, to suddenly challenge China right on its doorstep, it was a catastrophic kind of a situation which was developing. Later, when I discussed this, when I analyzed this deeper, I realized that the United States was really not taking a risk. It was perhaps convinced that there would be really no response. It was testing China. It was psychologically browbeating China. It was pushing it back and making China feel that it was not capable of responding conventionally to the United States challenge. It was no doubt a risk which had been taken at that particular time, and all of us perceived it. But the United States came out, well, not the winner. There is no winner or loser in this kind of a situation, but definitely came out as the dominant power. And that sent home a message very strongly to Beijing. At a particular time, this is just around the time of the 20th Congress of the Chinese Communist Party, that was also one of the very important factors which was playing in to tell China that it had to remain in its place while what was happening in Ukraine was resolved on the other front.
I know that India has quite a long list of grievances with China, and it is also being courted by the Americans to build this sort of counterbalance against China, both within the framework of Quad and possibly AUKUS. Do you think the Indian leadership is balanced enough to know where it's to sort of pick up its own battles to, you know, defend its interests, but without, providing some unnecessary services, war services for the Americans?
Thank you for that question. That's an excellent question. And I would say, I take your mind back to 1991. In 1991, India was down to its last $1 billion of foreign exchange reserves. As a nation, we were down in the dumps. Today, we are looking at becoming a $10 trillion economy by 2035. I think single-mindedly, the Indian leadership is looking at a qualitative upgradation of the quality of life of the Indian citizens in the future. We are not interested in war. We have got threats coming on our borders. We've got threats internally coming, being delivered to us. But India is the last nation which will want to go to war. We will want to make sure that we align ourselves, or should we say we can engage with many others who can come to our assistance if it comes to risky situations on our borders. And I think this relationship with the United States is based on that. It's a strategic relationship. We are not provoking China in any way. We are making strong statements primarily to exercise our right to tell China that it is acting aggressively on the borders and it could be risky. Two large nations, two nuclear weaponized nations cannot afford to do this kind of a thing. That's the message which is going out to China. But at the same time, we are aligning with the United States strategically because we feel that we have to ensure a balance in our approach. Our relationship with Russia is very strong. Most of our material equipment comes from Russia. It's very important for us to maintain that relationship. And you can see that India is also a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO. We are a member of that along with Russia and China. In fact, a future meeting is about to take place in one of our states, the state of Goa, in the very near future, where all these countries are going to be represented.
We have to leave it here. Our time is out. I'm very, very grateful for your conversation and participation in our program today.
It was the most enjoyable conversation that I had, and thank you for that.
Thank you very much, and thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.